Call the case.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Flory, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. Calling the case A20-0322, State of Minnesota versus Renee Gabrielle Ramos.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The usual rules of court will apply. Each side will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. Please state your name at the beginning of your argument because this is being recorded and it will be posted on our website. We didn't have problems with the first oral argument, people dropping out or technical difficulties, but if at any time your screen freezes or you can't hear us, please let us know so we can stop the clock and make sure that you get your allotted time. And with that, Ms. Jacks, are you ready to proceed?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sharon Jacks, and I'm the Assistant State Public Defender representing Renee Gabrielle Ramos and his challenge to his criminal sexual conduct conviction. Today, I'd like to focus on the first and third issues in appellant's brief. The first
before you get into that, Ms. Jacks, and the question I probably would want to ask at the end of your presentation, but I want to get it clear in my head at the beginning. The adjudication here was on count three.
Correct.
And count three is a case that requires penetration, multiple acts.
Correct.
So, but there were guilty findings on the other two counts, but no adjudication. So if in fact we would agree to reverse the current adjudication on count three, there'd be no need for a new trial, would there? Because the guilty findings are there. The guilty verdict is there for counts one and two, and the court could accept one or the other of those and adjudicate and sentence. Is that correct?
No, that's incorrect, Judge Klopaki, because if, you know, the argument is that it impacted all three of the jury verdicts. And so
well, that's assuming we agree that it impacted all three. Much
correct.
Of the discussion has to do with penetration, and counts one and two don't require penetration.
That's incorrect, Your Honor. Count one does not require penetration. Counts two and three do. But our
I thought two was pled as penetration or contact.
That's count one. And two of the counts require penetration and one is satisfied
okay.
If penetration is shown.
All right, then I'll revise the statement as to this just count one.
Yeah, and I'll explain my answer. The reason that you would have to reverse on all three is that although count one can be proved by genital-to-genital contact, the inquiry when determining whether or not there was prejudice in the admission of the statement is one of impact, not sufficiency of the evidence. So even if there is sufficient evidence of count one, that doesn't answer the question. The question then is whether or not the admission of the statement impacted the jury. And we know that it did because it found penetration as required on the other two. And also we can see how it impacted the jury by looking at how the prosecutor used the inadmissible statements. The prosecutor told the jury in opening to focus on it. The prosecutor twice elicited the inadmissible testimony, once through the child
boys. But it might be more accurate to say the impact was on the offenses that involved the penetration count rather than the contact count, wouldn't it?
Charge one was a impact, was a contact or penetration count. So given the way that the statements were used, we don't know that the jury believed her testimony as to contact or even considered it. Because as I was saying, you know, they focused on it in opening, they presented it twice, and then in closing, they replayed the video statement as to penetration. They quoted again Wise's statement about penetration and argued for multiple pages that the element, when you look to the closing argument as to count one, the element of contact or penetration, the prosecutor says to the jury, you can find him guilty if you find, if you believe his testimony, if you believe Wise's testimony, or if you believe the statement made in the child voice video. So it's our position that it did impact count one, too. And, you know, I'd point the court to State versus Caulfield. That's a Supreme Court case where the question was whether the defendant possessed cocaine, and the defendant admitted to the officer that the substance that he was possessing was cocaine. And the Supreme Court found that the admission of a BCA report that confirmed that it was cocaine was erroneously admitted. And then the court went on to say, and it did prejudice the defendant, because even though there was this admission of cocaine, there was sufficient evidence to prove that element. There is no way you could say or conclude, or it would be difficult to conclude, that the admission of the BCA report didn't impact the jury. And here, I think that it's abundantly clear that based on how the state used that prior statement, it did impact the jury. We know it impacted the jury on counts two and three, and it was the centerpiece of the state's closing argument on the first charge also. So that's why reversal is necessary. I take by your question that you would agree that the statement was incorrectly admitted.
Well, you shouldn't take anything from my questions other than the question.
Okay, then I'm going to tell you then why it was improperly admitted. Prior inconsistent statements are inadmissible because they're hearsay. And what we have here by Wise testimony is that there was genital-to-genital contact. She stated that no less than nine times during her testimony in response to leading and or non-leading questions. The prior statements, there were two prior statements that alleged penetration, not contact. That was the child voice video, and that was Ms. Person's testimony.
But the respondent says, well, maybe it's not exactly like the testimony, but it was consistent enough because when asked, she acknowledged, this is a leading question by the prosecution, but lone witness, but anyway, she acknowledged that after discussion what the cousin was doing, that your client was doing the same stuff or kind of same stuff.
Yeah, and I would focus the court on kind of. She didn't say the same stuff. She didn't say all the same stuff.
She said the same kind of stuff.
She said the same kind of stuff. And her testimony as to Antonio was that he touched her breast, he touched her private, and he digitally penetrated her. Mr. Ramos, according to her testimony, did do the same kind of stuff. He touched his private on her private. She makes no statement whatsoever as regarding penetration. And I will say that the state has really changed their whole theory here, because at trial, the prosecutor conceded to the district court that the statement was not consistent with her testimony. The prosecutor stated expressly that she did not testify to penetration. What the prosecutor argued was that the state...
I'm going to stop you because at pages 55 and 160 of the transcript of her testimony, she testified during cross-examination that her cousin, so not your client,
yes,
digitally penetrated her. And during her direct and redirect testimony, she said that her cousin was doing the same things as your client. So that does seem to be, as the case law says, reasonably consistent.
Well, she testified that appellant touched his private to her private. Then she said that Antonio did the same thing. Then she elaborated that Antonio also touched her breast and digitally penetrated her, and then ultimately was asked, did appellant do the same kind of stuff, not the same stuff, which she had said with respect to Antonio earlier, but the same kind of stuff. So that does not indicate that there was also penetration. And I would point the court again to, when you read that whole colloquy, Judge Riley, you see that 9 different times she's asked what happened, or it oftentimes in leading questions, repeating that it was his private touched her private. Never once was penetration mentioned. Never once was a finger mentioned. The prosecutor certainly could have asked that question had they wanted to. And as I said, the prosecutor below acknowledged that she did not testify as to penetration. And I cite that in my brief. I'm looking here, it's page 230. So I'd refer the court back to page 230. The prosecutor concedes that there was no testimony as to penetration and argues that the statements are consistent generally because they both indicate sexual abuse. And that's precisely what Bakken said doesn't come in. Here the court in Bakken, this court concluded that the district court had in fact erred by admitting the statement because it was only consistent as generally to sexual abuse, but there was actually additional information that came out with respect to an element of the offense. And that's what we have here. I would also say when you look to the closing argument of the state never once argues to the jury that they can find Mr. Gabriel Ramos guilty because why testified to penetration. What the prosecutor argued is you can find her guilty. You can find him guilty because she testified to genital-genital contact. And you can infer from that genital-genital contact that there probably or there must have been penetration. She just didn't know how to say that. Well, had the prosecutor asked the question, perhaps she would have said it. I think we have to look at the whole record here and question a little bit what's going on. The prosecutor knows going into trial that the only allegation is digital penetration. And then the prosecutor at trial never asks if that happened. It seems that the prosecutor knew that she was not going to acknowledge that at trial and therefore was avoiding the question. If we get then to person's testimony, there's no question that that statement by the physician's assistant that there was this prior digital penetration could not come in because it was inconsistent. This case is different, and I know we've already talked in quite some detail about the prejudice element in response to Judge Klopaki's questions, but I just want to emphasize here that unlike Bakken, where the jury acquitted of the offenses that involved this additional evidence, here the opposite was true. Now, as to the second issue that I'd like to address here, that is the district court's error in admitting 7 statements by the police officer indicating that he didn't believe appellant's denials of the sexual abuse, as well as the prosecutor's misconduct in eliciting those statements in Spanish. The state has conceded that it was error to permit the 7 additional statements in English. And I think we highlight those 7 statements on pages 34 through 36 of our brief. As to the Spanish statements, the court ruled those statements were inadmissible. Those statements were inadmissible because they would prejudicially impact the jury in evaluating whether or not why or Gabriel Ramos who was telling the truth. Yet one of the jurors heard all of them in addition to the 7 additional statements that should have been redacted. And those statements, the state is making an argument that they're different statements because they're in Spanish, but that's not the case. The interpreter is simply a conduit, as the Supreme Court recently acknowledged in State versus Lopez Ramos, the interpreter statements are the declarant statements. They aren't different statements. And so given this case really came down to who did the jury believe, and given there were no other eyewitnesses, seven statements from a police officer indicating that that police officer did not believe the defendant's denials certainly had an impact on the jury. And I'd point the court to State versus Hogvet to support that proposition as well as State versus Saldana. In Hogvet, the vouching testimony was particularly prejudicial because of the fact that it came from a police officer. And the same is true here.
I note that after defense counsel's motion to suppress some of these statements and the court granted it, there was no follow-up about making sure that the Spanish statements would be excised. Whose obligation is it? Is it defense counsel? Is it prosecution? Is it the court? Everyone?
I have two responses to that question, Judge Riley. I see my time is running short here. May I have another minute?
You may.
Thank you. First of all, the state said that the defense counsel understood that they had not been redacted because of the transcript that the judge gave the defense counsel. But that's not the case. The transcript that the judge gave defense counsel didn't have those statements on there. It just had little notes, speaking Spanish. So counsel would have assumed upon receiving that the Spanish statements had been redacted. That being said, under McNeil, there's no question it's misconduct, even if the state unintentionally fails to redact the inadmissible evidence. But as we note in our brief, all the parties had some responsibility here. And ultimately the question for this court is whether or not Mr. Gabriel Ramos was denied a fair trial, and whether you put the blame at the feet of the prosecutor, the judge, or defense counsel, the bottom line is one of the jurors heard all of the evidence that the judge had ruled inadmissible because it would interfere with that individual's ability to evaluate the credibility of the witnesses. So for that reason, as well as the other reasons that we addressed in appellant's brief, we'd ask that you reverse and remand for a new trial.
Thank you, Ms. Jacks. Mr. Smith.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith. I'm a special assistant Nobles County attorney, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota in this appeal. I want to jump right into Judge Klopaki's question about whose responsibility it was and whether there was prosecutorial error in inadvertently not redacting these Spanish statements here. First of all, the district court made it clear that it had intended to grant all of the relief that defense counsel requested and had provided counsel, both the prosecutor and defense counsel, with a transcript where it had specifically highlighted the portions of the interview, specifically the portions of the officer's questions that were redacted. Some of those were so precise as to be portions of questions, not even the entire question. The court never once redacted any Spanish. Not that the Spanish was there word for word, but there was clearly a placeholder indicating that the Spanish was present. And appellant's entire argument that the prosecutorial misconduct here or error was plain error is based on the notion that the district court had specifically ruled that the statements that were inadvertently admitted were specifically excluded. And given the specificity with which the district court issued its order in this case, I simply don't think that that is a sound premise. It cannot be plain where the district court goes so far as to say, take these six words out of this question, to then argue that the prosecutor plainly erred and violated the court's order when it didn't redact things that weren't highlighted.
I'm wondering, and not to excuse what happened, but it looks like the motion in limine occurred before voir dire, and at least in Hennepin County, we would not have a lot of potential jurors who would speak Spanish. So I'm wondering if the judge made the orders and then people just forgot to deal with the Spanish once they figured out that they had a Spanish-speaking two jurors.
I think that's entirely possible that that's the kind of, you know, oversight that went on here. The district court was trying to give the defendant everything the defendant asked for. And the prosecutor is clear on the record that he's trying to comply completely with the district court's order regarding the redaction of the statement. And for appellant to now argue when he was given the opportunity by the district court to have the district court take curative action, that this action constituted plain prosecutorial error and plain error by the district court judge, when his counsel made a choice, deliberately made a choice, was presented with the option to make a choice explicitly by the district court, and specifically and explicitly did not ask the district court to do anything to cure the error, it defeats the purpose of the plain error doctrine for appellant to now argue on appeal that the burden should shift, first of all, to the state to demonstrate that the alleged error didn't prejudice the defendant's substantial rights. The plain error doctrine is designed to address these, to encourage parties to address these issues in the district court. If anything, defendant should have to make out an ineffective assistance of counsel claim here. He partially pursued that in post-conviction relief and was not able to establish prejudice from the admission of these statements. The district court on post-conviction relief here concluded that the admission of these statements did not prejudice the defendant. Now, I'm not arguing that this court has to defer to that prejudice argument, but what counsel has done, what appellant has done, is changed his horses midstream. He initially argued, yes, this was my attorney's primary error. And when that didn't work, he's now blaming everyone else mostly and only his trial attorney somewhat. But this is a quintessential strategic decision about what to do when evidence comes in that is problematic. And defense counsel has to make a reasoned judgment in the heat of the moment about whether to request curative action or to simply move on and hope that the jurors won't notice. And here that was a reasonable action by appellant's trial counsel, because there was one juror who would sit and deliberate who heard and understood these statements. And that is a reasonable judgment that that's not going to have a substantial effect on
the reasonable judgment rule goes to whether or not, I'm sorry, am I muted? No, the reasonable judgment issue goes to whether or not there was ineffective assistance of counsel. Appellant now says, no, listen, this, the issue here is whether the defendant got a fair trial. So it doesn't matter.
Well, it does matter, because if we're looking at plain error by the district court, or if we're looking at plain error under the guise of prosecutorial misconduct, that's not the end of the analysis. And I take serious issue with appellant's application of the plain error standard here. The appellant has relied on cases from this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court that were decided before Griller adopted the Olano plain error standard, and conflates the question of fair trial, which is the question of whether is prong three, whether the error affected the appellant's substantial rights, with prong four, which is a broader test and which says that not every error that affects substantial rights merits the grant of a new trial, because the question is whether the error is such that it calls the integrity and reputation of the entire judicial proceedings, not just this specific trial.
Counsel, I don't want to direct you as to how you want to use your precious time here, but maybe there are quite a few other issues that you want to address. One of them that I'd like to address is the statement by the quote, so-called medical provider. There's nothing about, as I look at it, to indicate that she's engaging in any kind of diagnosis here.
Sure, and I think that to a certain extent, the district court might have been a little bit off base in that conclusion. If you look at the transcripts, there's actually substantial confusion from the district court and counsel about whether Ms. Person actually testified that the appellant specifically did this. Now, we in hindsight have the benefit of the transcript, and we can see that she did say that the victim said that appellant digitally penetrated her. But when you look back at the transcripts, what you see is the district court did not have that understanding of the testimony, and neither did either of the attorneys who didn't have a transcript in front of them, who didn't have the opportunity of a steno reporter who could read back the testimony. What we had is a digital reporter. So they were doing the best that they could, and the district court specifically, to make a decision based on the record as the district court and counsel understood it. And counsel.
Okay, so the record, but we now know the record that the trial judge thought she had was wrong.
Correct.
And all right, so where does that leave the defendant?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because we know the information that the district court was operating on when it exercised its discretion. And we have to remember that this is an abuse of discretion. And we're not supposed to be second guessing and Monday morning quarterbacking these decisions. Now, it would seem on one hand, right, that there's a clear error of fact. It would seem like that. But the district court didn't operate under that same understanding. Moreover, ultimately, I think the important thing here is that person's testimony as to that point was simply duplicative of the child's voice interview. So and because the state maintains that the child's voice interview itself was properly admitted as a prior consistent statement, any possible error in admitting that testimony could not have prejudiced the appellant. And that's a good transition into the question of the consistency of the child's voice interview. Counsel for appellant is isolating statements from trial testimony and the statements in the interview from their context. And the context is that both the interview and the trial testimony of the victim are consistent. In the interview,
if that's true, why does the state's attorney make this lengthy argument, final argument, that you can draw these inferences from the contact that there was penetration? Because if, as you said, what you just said is accurate, you wouldn't have needed that kind of argument, would you?
Well, he might not well have needed that kind of argument. What I would say is, I think that appellant has mischaracterized somewhat the prosecutor's closing argument. And as the Supreme Court has recently reminded us, when looking at the question of alleged prosecutorial misconduct in closing argument, you must view the argument as a whole in the context of the whole record of the trial. And what you have here is a victim who had difficulty testifying explicitly about details. That is consistent. She's able at various times to provide some details, but at other times can't provide verbal responses, particularly in the child's voice interview, but is shaking her head and those sorts of things.
Is there anything in the record why she is so explicit about the cousin, but has difficulty in being similarly explicit about the defendant?
There isn't. And the interesting thing I would point out to the court is that as I was looking back at the child's voice interview, it was actually flipped. If I remember correctly, she tended to be more explicit about what the uncle did in the child's voice interview and less explicit about what the cousin did. And I think part of that is just what questions are being asked first. And the point is, two important points as my time starts to windle away here quickly. Throughout her interview and her trial testimony, she has consistently testified that both her uncle and her cousin did the same things to her. I think in the child's voice interview, she used things, or in her trial testimony, she used things, and one of them she used stuff. But that's what she's explaining. And she was consistent about that across both the statement and the interview. And now we're coming back and we're saying, well, but that's not the same. But it is. She's consistently said that both men did the same things to her. She said that in the Child's Voice interview. She did it with a little more detail regarding the uncle there. And she did it with a little more detail regarding the cousin at trial. First of all, I think we should be mindful that the prosecutor is generally obligated to ask open-ended questions on direct examination, and did so. Whereas defense counsel gets to ask pointed, leading questions on cross. And it's in response to those pointed leading questions from defense counsel that we get details. And I think that demonstrates well that when the advocate is allowed to ask pointed questions, you can get detailed answers. But where the prosecutor is trying to follow the general requirement that he use only open-ended questions to elicit testimony on direct examination, you get less detailed statements from a child victim witness. And I think
isn't the record reflect though that her answer affirmatively as to whether the defendant did the same kind of stuff was on redirect and it was a leading question?
That was on redirect and it was a leading question that wasn't objected to. The form of the question was certainly something I suppose defense counsel could have objected to, but didn't. And so we have the answer. And I, just from practical experience, I think prosecutors are probably given a little more leeway to ask more direct questions on redirect because I think everyone wants to move along. but I think that that's important to bear in mind here, how the testimony came in. And I think that's the other thing about the prosecutor's statements in closing argument, is he's not arguing that the jurors can infer penetration solely from the victim's testimony about genital contact. He's arguing that under the whole circumstances here, in light of the Child's Voice interview, which was admissible and he could rely upon in making his argument, we have to bear that in mind because it had been admitted. He's permitted to make arguments based on the admission of that evidence, and it's not misconduct to make arguments based on inferences that can be drawn from that evidence, even if this court later concludes that that was error. He made those. He argued that the jury should look at the whole evidence, the way the victim was able to provide information, and suggested that based on the totality of that, they could draw an inference based on all of her testimony, based on the interview, that she was trying to explain penetration. In light of that, in light of all of the arguments set forth in my brief, the state respectfully asked this court to affirm appellant's conviction.
Judge Riley, if I could ask one question.
Certainly.
Thank you.
You're reminding me of the attorneys who say, I have only one more question, and then there's a...
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to interrupt the flow of the argument, and I would caution both counsel here not to read anything into the premise of this question. But from the state's perspective, my question is on the Child Voice interview. If we were to find that the court abused its discretion in admitting the statement, does the state then concede that prejudice resulted from that error?
Your Honor, yes, I think that it would be very difficult and in fact nearly impossible for me to argue that the admission of the Child's Voice interview here would not be prejudicial if it were error. I think that's a very tough row for me to hoe, and that's why I didn't make an argument about that in my brief. I think the state's position is far stronger that it was never error. And that's the reasonable argument for me to make. And that's why I've argued that the way I have.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Judge Riley.
You're welcome. Good questioning. Ms. Jacks, any rebuttal?
Well, with respect to the consistency of the Child Voice statement and the testimony, I'd just like to point out that 7 of the times that Y reaffirmed that there was genital-to-genital contact was based on leading questions from the state. They included, for instance, the touching of Renee Gabrielle Ramos' private part to your private part, is that what you were saying happened on more than one occasion? There are 7 questions like that where within the question from the prosecutor, he repeats her statement that there was genital-to-genital contact, as opposed to asking any questions about digital touch or digital penetration, or was
there, were no objections to those questions, were there?
There were not. There were not. That's absolutely right, Judge Klopaki. I say it only in response to the state's claim that they weren't asking any questions at trial. And the only other point I'd like to make, and this goes back to the other issue, which is the whether or not the Spanish statements should have come in, or the other English statements. We're not, Judge Riley is right. Perhaps it was an oversight. My opposing counsel is correct. Perhaps everybody missed something. But I mean, the bottom line is all the case law says that that's error. And then the question only becomes whether or not it was prejudicial. And it's prejudicial.
I just want to back up. You said the Spanish or the English statements. I could you clarify what you mean?
The interpreter's statements repeating what defense counsel said. You had indicated that maybe it was an oversight because the motion to suppress occurred before voir dire. I don't remember the timing of that, but the tape was certainly played after voir dire. And my only point to you is, even if it was just an oversight, it's an error under—
I agree that they shouldn't. I think we all agree that they probably shouldn't have come in.
Yeah.
And so then
the question becomes, were they prejudicial or not? And given it was a he said, she said case, and there were no eyewitnesses, an officer's opinion repeatedly telling the jury that, in fact, he didn't believe the defendant, certainly impacted the verdict. And for those reasons, we'd ask that this court reverse and remand for a new trial.
Thank you both for your thorough briefing and your arguments today, and we will have our decision out within the statutory timeframe.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And